Warren Buffett, BlackRock, and other institutional players dominate investments in commercial aviation. Why? Because it's one of the most profitable and predictable alternative assets that exists. And it's not tied to other markets, such as real estate and the stock market. Is it safe? Well, imagine triple net leases to the likes of American Airlines and British Airways. Income is contractual and guaranteed by some of the biggest named airlines in the world. That's why this kind of investment was never available to the ordinary accredited investor. That is until now. Visit accesswealthaviation.com and check it out for yourself. Invest in an institutional team with over 200 plus years of combined investment experience in the aviation sector. Conservative investing with double-digit returns and tax advantages. That's accesswealthaviation.com, accesswealthaviation.com.
You are listening to the Wealth Formula Podcast with Buck Joffrey. Get ready to change your life.
Welcome, everybody. This is Buck Joffrey with the Wealth Formula Podcast coming to you from Montecito, California. Today, I want to start reminding you that there is a website called wealthformula.com. You may want to check that out for some of the resources available with this show, including some of the groups that you can join, including our investor club, which is for accredited investors, people who are interested in private investments, lots of different kinds of things coming up over the next year. Real estate's pretty darn slow right now, but we've got a lot of interesting things in aviation sectors, M&A, things like that. Cool stuff. Check it out. Go to wealthformula.com and sign up for the investor club. Now, today I want to talk to you. I guess this is a little bit, apropos of the whole concept of private investments. You know, a lot of private investments are, they're off Wall Street, right? They're not really part of the stuff that is packaged up into financial products and traded publicly. Those things that have typically been, what we call Wall Street. So the notion of moving away from Wall Street into the hands of smaller private operator sounds great. And again, this is not that it's only small, neighborhood people putting stuff together. This is private equity stuff. This is, these are major operators as well. We recently had CAF on. This is a phenomenal large operator that we work with, large aviation type things. But the bottom line is there's a lot of challenges in this space, and that's important to acknowledge. Because of the regulatory framework or lack thereof in the private space, it becomes potentially very dangerous in the hands of the non-Wall Street unsophisticated investor. And that's just true, whether you hate Wall Street or not. It is a challenge, right? And so we have to acknowledge that those challenges of navigating these waters and challenges that, frankly, that many have witnessed firsthand in the podcast ecosystem over the past 2 years. Now, first and foremost, let's talk about vetting, right? Because, and before we get to vetting, even investing is hard with the ideal operator and business plan. You still have economic cycles, inflation and interest rates, things like that come out of the blue and kick you in the butt. Sometimes projects fail. Right? These are investment realities that are there before you even choose an operator. And that's just investing, right? That is just investing. And we've gone, as I've said before, we've been 15 years where it seemed like pretty much anything that anybody who wasn't trying to cheat you would actually make money. And suddenly things have changed a little bit and there are some losses that are incurring that are essentially, I hate to say it, but no one screwed you, so to speak, or screwed me. I just lost money in this situation. That's kind of what happened, right? That kind of reality is it's a little bit easier to swallow because you can say that, the economy, interest rates, and all these kinds of things, it's sort of like, it's like Mother Nature. I mean, like you got to be angry at Mother Nature, and everybody hates, of course, natural disaster, but you're not getting angry with the weather itself or the clouds or the cloud systems. But vetting, right? Of course, there is a vetting process as well, and not all operators are created equal, and the vetting process becomes paramount. So how do you ensure that these operators have the acumen, integrity, and due diligence to manage your wealth responsibly. It's not enough, frankly, to say know, like, and trust. I mean, that's a nice thing to say, but know, like, and trust, that, I mean, that can be, you know, your in-law who you think is a good guy, but, you know, it doesn't mean you're going to, you know, trust him, right? Beyond that, you can do background checks. You look at resumes and track records. You can ask all the right questions and even get all the right answers. And all of this is helpful, but limited ultimately to historical data, right? In other words, as the old saying goes, past performance does not indicate future results. And so far, all of this applies equally to Wall Street and Main Street. But I'd argue that one variable that's much harder to control Main Street is the bad actor, right? You would be correct, by the way, in pointing out that the most famous of modern-day Ponzi schemes was perpetrated by Bernie Madoff, whatever, tomato, tomato. You know, and he was, after all, Wall Street's godfather. You know, he was the anointed one. But that just doesn't happen that often with the big boys. And that's the truth. Too much red tape, regulation, heavy hitting due diligence by sophisticated investors and institutions. It makes it very, very challenging for, you know, something that head to toe is fraudulent to work. And the bad actors know that. So they generally set their sights on easier targets, like, you know, retail investors. They lurk at our events. They make, you know, the podcast circuit. By the way, it's for this reason that I no longer interview anyone from outside of my own circle actively who is raising capital. I just won't do it. It's also the reason that we now use in our group an SEC registered broker dealer that conducts due diligence independently on pretty much everything that we do through Investor Club. It's an extra step, but it's an extra layer of protection. Is it completely 100% bulletproof? No, it's not. Nothing's bulletproof, but we can do a lot more than I think a lot of people do in this space to make sure that everything is, I's are dyed, T's are crossed, and that it's as clean as you can possibly be to avoid these kinds of things. And that's the goal, really, right? Now, so how do you identify a bad actor anyway? You know, we talked about a lot of the due diligence and that sort of thing, which I certainly have been doing a lot of lately. But, you know, sometimes it's easy. You know, for example, one of the funds that was circulating in the podcast ecosystem, you know, last year, a year before that, was at a founder who, I looked at this thing and there was people raising money for this who are, you know, pretty high profile in the space. And I'm looking at it going, what is this thing? I can't even locate the CEO who was touted as a major player in the oil and gas industry, doing business with, you know, world's top oil and gas companies and all that. You put the guy's name in and you couldn't even find him on Google. I mean, geez, come on. You can't even find him on Google, and he's supposed to be some big, you know, guy. So it just doesn't really make sense. So sometimes it's not that hard to stay away from these things, right? But sometimes it's less obvious, and you just have to know how to look for clues that hopefully is going to help you and get you from being victimized. But no guarantee. Again, look at those Bernie Madoff people, were pretty smart too, right? Those investors. But anyway, how do you look for clues? What are the clues? My guest this week, interesting guy that we're going to talk into in a moment, James Brandolino. He is an expert in this space. He's identifying fraud in part because he once ran his own Ponzi scheme. So anyway, interesting story, and we're going to have it for you right after these messages.
What do the Rothschilds, the Romneys, and the billionaire hedge fund managers know that you don't about growing and protecting wealth? As you might imagine, the wealthy have a few tricks up their sleeves. One strategy allows you to grow wealth tax-free at a compounding rate with no volatility. It protects your money from creditors and lawsuits, and it lets you invest the same money in two different places at the same time. How about that for amplifying wealth? To learn more, go to wealthformulabanking.com. Again, that's wealthformulabanking.com.
Welcome back to the show, everyone. Today, my guest on Wealth Formula Podcast is James Brandolino. James is an expert in the field of investment fraud prevention. With a mission of reducing the number of investors and organizations defrauded by teaching the critical red flags leading to investment firms. He works with law enforcement, brokerage firms, insurance companies, and has helped to recover tens of millions of dollars and prevent further victimization. James, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Buck, for inviting me.
Let's just start right off. And, you know, when you are an expert in fraud prevention, but that comes from knowing a little bit, maybe a little bit too much about it. So how did your career begin?
So I really wanted to trade on one of Chicago's exchanges back since I was in high school, after the movie was released, Trading Places, in summer of 83. I just finished my freshman year in high school, where Dan Aykroyd and Eddie Murphy are, you know, trying to corner the orange juice market. And I attended the University of Illinois in Chicago and was a runner on one of the exchange's floors, and basically went to Charles Schwab after that, and then back to Chicago to clerk on one of the exchanges. And I was an ops manager and trade desk manager for a very large derivatives firm at the time, MF Global. And I had designed a trading program, a long-term trading program for treasury bonds that my clients liked. It earned about, 6% per year, very uncorrelated to, what their traditional asset classes were doing. And I had left there in June of 99 to start my own small futures brokerage firm so I could solicit investors and clients to begin trading it as a broker. So really, after 3 years and, good results, a good track record, in February of 2003, I decided to go out on my own. I became a member of the Board of Trade in Chicago and formed a futures, hedge fund, and raised money from family, friends, former brokerage clients, and decided that I would, take that path.
Yeah.
And really what the catalyst was in my particular case, in my fraud, was when I was on the trading floor waiting for the Board of Trade to actually come up and set up my trading desk and my internet and everything like that. I'm standing in front of the Dow Jones futures pit and watching all of the orders coming in and out. And I'm thinking to myself, boy, oh boy, if I could just, make a few modifications to my trading models, and I could make another 300-400 basis points and be in that 9-10% per year, I'd be a hero.
Right.
And, just kind of on a flim, and, my clients were not unhappy with my returns. It was just a small piece of their portfolio. And basically I took a week off and made some changes to my models, did some really quick testing. Everything tested okay, not great, but okay. But, I traded for a long time, was successful. I could, we'll make it work. Well, after the first week of actually trading, my new fund on the trading floor, I was down about 3%. Mm-hmm. And I'm thinking to myself, well, okay, I've got a couple more weeks now before the CPA firm that's going to actually do my numbers is going to get the statements and going to send the numbers out. And I'm thinking, well, how am I going to tell my clients? Yeah, I've been with them a long time, and family and friends, but, it's going to be really difficult. What are they going to do? They may pull out. What am I going to do as a career now, right, if I have to close my fund? And, showing how fast that it happens, I'm sitting in an office in the Board of Trade with one of my colleagues. He's on the phone. I'm paging through Institutional Investor magazine. And what do I see? The light bulb goes off, an advertisement for hedge fund accounting software. And just like that, I'm thinking, all I've got to do is buy this software, put everybody's name in there, send statements out showing a small gain instead of a 3% loss. And 3%, Buck, I can make that back in a month, two months tops. And we'll turn it around. I called my CPA firm and said, look, I found someone else. And they're like, okay, fine. If you need us, let us know. And, sure enough, I sent those statements out thinking I could make the money back. And of course, minus 3%, minus 5%, minus 10%, minus 20%, and so on.
So just to interrupt you real quick, I guess that's one of the, one of the things that generally, like, whenever I'm looking for signs of fraud, one of the things I look about is just there's an outside accounting firm, and you effectively kind of eliminated that because you brought it inside. And so is that one of the things that you typically would kind of address it when you're trying to assess for fraud?
Absolutely. So yeah. in my documents, it was specifically stated, and actually in my literature as well, my marketing literature, that there would be a third party CPA firm that was going to, you know, do all of the returns and send, right, mail everything to clients. And of course that never happened. All of the envelopes came from with my, you know, letter on my letterhead and, you know, address from my office, and nobody ever questioned it.
Yeah.
We'll get a lot more into that when we talk about, you know, accounting and audits. But in terms of a big red flag, that's something that nobody ever questioned, and they should have.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So yeah, keep going with the story.
Okay. So that's really part one of my fraud, that I took my statements and my customer statements and I fudged them.
Yeah. Well, you had to cover the money somehow, right? How were you covering the money?
Yeah. Well, and I thought that I could, and, you know, understand that most investment fraud does not start out as investment fraud. That's what makes Ponzi schemes so difficult to uncover. Everything, you know, usually goes okay. Now, in my case, it was the first week it did start out kind of as a Ponzi scheme, but everything else about me was legitimate. There was no other issues there. So it comes to the point where about a year and a half later or so, I started, you know, the fund starts dwindling down and I need some additional cash. And I was really at the time a sales introvert and didn't really want to go back to my clients, investors, and ask them for more money. So I basically, you know, put my net worth into it. And I got a home equity line of credit. I, you know, cashed in my 401k and yada, yada, yada. My whole net worth went in there. That was, you know, stage two.
So just to clarify, real quick. So you didn't actually, when you think of Ponzi scheme, a lot of times you think of like bringing new money in and paying that out. That's not what you were doing. You were actually putting your own money in. Is that right?
Well, at that time, I had not taken any additional money in.
Okay. Got it.
I just put my own money in.
Okay.
So now we're in stage two. So basically I'm subsidizing the losses with my personal net worth and did not disclose that to my investors, which is also an SEC violation. Uh-huh. Okay. So that went on for about another year. So now we're about that 3-year mark. And up to this point, you know, although I'm committing fraud, it's civil. Correct. Mm-hmm. I haven't stolen any money.
Right.
It's that point. And about that 3-year mark, I probably have $25,000 or so in the fund account. I'm like, well, I've got to sit everybody down. What am I going to do? Somebody's probably going to go to the authorities.
Yeah.
And just kind of out of nowhere, I get a call from an investor who was a referral from one of my quote unquote happy investors. And he wrote a check for $500,000, which was by far my largest client. I'm thinking, well, that's great. Number one, because I can, you know, I could maybe bring in, you know, a quant analyst or bring in somebody else to help me with my models, but also too, I need money to live on because I was just completely tapped.
Sure.
So it was just a great opportunity to push forward because really in my 8 years, it was really never more than a couple of days, Buck, where I didn't think I could make the money back.
Right.
You know, I had traded for a long time. I mean, I had really been trading futures since high school. Mm-hmm. Right. So I never thought that there was an issue that I couldn't make the money back.
Right.
And so really this is the turning point. And I didn't, you know, probably know it as clear as I do now. I mean, that was when the lexicon changed from civil to criminal. Right. And I knew that it was wrong that I'd be taking money, but I justified it because I can make this money back. And, you know, of course, you know, from year 3 to year 8, I never made it back. And that's really where the embezzlement came from.
So I think what you're, the moral of the story here is a lot of times the investment fraud, Ponzi schemes like these don't start out with the intent of that. I think even with Bernie Madoff, I don't think he intended for it to be that way initially. And it just became that because it was sort of a, well, we'll just fudge a little bit here, fudge a little bit there. And the next thing you know, it just becomes this gigantic problem. Is that pretty fair? Is that most of the time that's the way it works?
So I would say probably 70% or so, maybe 75% of all investment fraud / Ponzi schemes do not start out that way. And that's what makes them so difficult to uncover, is because when a lot of people get into the Ponzi schemes, especially at an early stage, there is no fraud going on. Right.
Yeah.
So it's very difficult. So maybe the fraud starts 6 months later or a year later or 3 years later. A catalyst occurs, right? The market goes the wrong way. Real estate values go down. Technology for a new product doesn't work.
Right.
Yeah. One of your sales team doesn't get that government contract that it needs, right? Something happens. So of course, embezzlement doesn't start from day one. It's the operator who is trying to fudge the numbers, create false statements to buy more time.
Right.
And that's where it starts. Now, eventually it gets into embezzlement. It's one of two. In my case, it was both number one, to live on some of that money because I threw my net worth into there, but also to show success, not so much a lavish lifestyle, but success that yes, I am making money. I am successful.
Right.
I am doing what I say that I'm doing.
Right.
And here's proof, the BMW and the travel and the yada, yada, yada. Right.
Sure.
So that's where that comes in. But embezzlement usually does not start from day one. I mean, very few people wake up, I'm sorry, Buck, one morning and say, you know what, I want to steal $10, $20, $30, $50 million, go and, you know, open a bank account and, you know, go to Wix, get a website and, you know, go online and, you know, find a document or documents to forge and put their stamp, their name on it and go out and raise money. And as soon as they get that phone call from the SEC or knock on the door, they're in the back door, you know, you're fueling up the corporate jet to go to Brazil. Right. So that doesn't usually happen that often.
Well, let's just, let's jump into some of the, some of the major red flags. I think you talk about five major red flags that might indicate fraudulent activity, because I think that's kind of the big, that's probably the thing that people are going to want to know the most.
Right. Absolutely. So number one, I would say, when somebody calls me and it says either I have this, some documents, they were given to me by a friend of a friend and he wants me to invest in this. Would you look at it? Or the other side of that, I invested in something, a couple of years ago and I'm making money. I'm not worried, but would you look into it? And the first question I ask is, how were you approached? Was it your neighbor? Was it your neighbor's kid? Was it your nephew? Was it, somebody from your church? Was it somebody from just a phone call randomly or via the internet? And really what I'm trying to find out is, most individuals, operators who raise money, raise it under a 506B or 506C entity, a Reg D exemption.
Yeah. So
they can bypass, the full registration for the SEC.
So what you're trying to find out is at least if they've gone through the steps of actually try to formally raise money, right? And are doing it in a proper way.
Correct.
Right.
And I would say number one, how did they ask you, if at all, if you are accredited?
Right.
That's number one. And really to find out the name of the entity and really go to the SEC website, Edgar, and just search that company and see if they filed a Form D with the SEC.
And just to be, just to clarify there, there is a little bit of a small difference, because sometimes you have a Reg D 506C and Reg D 506B. In a Reg D 506C, they would technically not have to ask you if you're accredited. You're essentially, you're allowed to solicit in that case, and you just need to make people know that it's only for accredited investors and that they'll be required for third-party validation. So just that small nuance, I think, is important. A 506B, right, where that's a different type of thing. You have to kind of go through get to know you process. We actually even have that on our website and onboarding type thing. So what else? Let's talk about other things. So you have proper SEC, trying to do things by the book, approaching the right way. What else?
So let's go into audits.
Mm-hmm. That's a good one.
Really? Yeah. It's a big one. And depending upon the type of entity, I mean, audits aren't cheap, right? Audits are expensive. I mean, they were expensive when, back in the day when I was, legitimate in getting one. So let's see how they work. So, audits mean different things to different people. But for anybody that's running a fund or investing in a fund, look, it's really simple. Number one, an audit's is going to verify, are the assets real? Do they exist?
Mm-hmm.
How are they valued? Are they being valued correctly according to GAAP? And how are the assets being custodied if that's even a word, right?
Right.
You know, where are they held and how are they, you know, registered, et cetera, et cetera. And really what the, there's quite a few issues with audits that we see. So in my case, everything was completely false, was completely illegitimate. And I'll give you a you know, a quick story on that. So I get a call 6 months into my, into my fraud. One of my investors, hey, you know, we've been talking here, you know, do you have any financial statements that are audited? Well, of course I do. Yeah. Give me a few weeks. I'll have my CPA firm get them out to you. Right. There was no CPA firm.
Right.
And I just made up a CPA firm name and went to our friend google.com and did a search hedge fund, you know, audited statements.pdf, probably got 10 that came up, found one that was pretty close to something that traded securities, and went in, followed the format, recreated the securities and sent it out. And no one ever verified that the CPA firm existed, which it didn't, or if the actual audit was real.
Right.
And they had every chance. Not only were my investors looking at this, but also so were their CPAs and, you know, and their attorneys. Mm-hmm. So what we really see is this. So there's a couple points I want to make here. So when you have an audit, when an operator gives an investor an audit, either the audit's real or it's not real. So you want to, of course, double check to see if the CPA himself or herself and or the firm is licensed. You can go to cpaverify.org or go to your local, your state, website, registration website, and see if they're real. That's not an issue. But what's really difficult, especially for individual investors, is you have to confirm, you've got to verify whether or not that actual audit was actually completed, was performed by that particular CPA and CPA firm. Because he may have done it in its entirety. He may not have done it at all. Maybe the bad actor just picked some firm randomly out of the phone book and just, you know, stuck his name on it. But what's actually, we see more, and it's really difficult, is the operator will have a real audit done. So if in case anyone calls the audit firm and says, hey, did you do an audit for, you know, for XYZ fund? And they say yes. And, you know, there's an issue when the operator will change maybe 4, 5, 6 numbers.
Right.
We'll change valuations. We'll change cash on hand. We'll change whatever. Add some zeros. Move some decimal places over, and it's really difficult to find that out.
Right.
But without an actual audit itself, it's really, really difficult to find out.
Yeah.
And a lot of firms won't even verify the fact that they are, you know, that someone is their client, and you've got to play hardball and say, you know, I tell investors, you know, say, hey, you know, you've already done a basic due diligence. Now you're doing an extended due diligence. Not saying there's anything wrong, but this guy's using your name to see, you know, that you audited his statements, you know, and we just want to verify, you know, send me if you did it for him, send a copy to me, what you sent to him, so I can verify if what I have is correct.
Yeah.
And some firms will and some firms won't. So it's a matter of really putting your foot down. And, you know, I think in the end, most will, because most don't want to get caught up that they were complicit in fraud.
Yeah.
But that's really, really important. And I'm sure you've seen stuff as well, Buck, in terms of, you know, fake financial statements or fudged financial statements, right?
Yeah. I mean, I think like part of, part of what we do in some of these things is, you know, try to dig into the financials and due diligence and that kind of thing. And, it is reassuring to us. Probably the biggest thing is when an outside accounting firm is willing to sign and verify, you know, financials, because it makes makes us feel like they're actually putting their own neck on the line, so to speak, right? And not so that's I think a very helpful thing. But what else? I mean, obviously that's a big one, right? You're talking about essentially, having some level of third party verification via audit. What other types of things that maybe we're not thinking about?
So what we see a lot of in fraud and even in non-fraudulent cases are PPMs that are taken right from other PPMs.
Yeah.
You know, and it's not so much even the boilerplate information and the risk stuff, but it could be stuff about, you know, their backgrounds. So basically a PPM is a private placement memorandum,
right.
a disclosure mm-hmm. document, a prospectus. And it could be, you know, I've seen ones that are, you know, 10, 15 pages. I've seen, you know, ones that are, you know, 80 to 100 pages, but probably 20, 25, 30 pages is about average. And, you know, don't get me wrong. A lot of attorneys, as they're writing these, are using a lot of
templates,
the same boilerplate.
Yeah.
So, exactly. So if somebody were to go in and I mean, I'm not sure how using Grammarly would work, but I have some pretty good software that you can really see if it's been plagiarized.
Yeah.
And it'll pull up a lot of different things. And when you see a sentence here and a sentence there, it's not that big of a deal. But when you're seeing paragraph after paragraph,
yeah.
Which means they probably didn't have an attorney do it, which isn't against the law.
Right.
But it's something that should be considered. But if they're pulling, you know, stuff about their technology,
yeah.
about, you know, how they do business. It's doesn't show fraud, but it's just it's a big, big
yeah.
red flag.
Yeah.
And especially too on the risk section.
Sure.
So a lot of CPAs, I'm sure you would verify this, Buck, is that a lot of CPAs or attorneys will require that you put everything in there except the kitchen sink. Right.
Yep.
Because you want to protect yourself. Right.
Yep.
I'll give you an example. Something that a case that I just got done reviewing, two of the research individuals were from Ukraine. And there uh-huh. was a large paragraph that if the war in Ukraine got much worse, that if these gentlemen had to go back home to take care of family for whatever reason, it could negatively impact the fund, right? And I never really kind of thought about it. Maybe that was overkill. But look, you know, it's hard enough to make money trading or you know,
yeah,
in business regularly.
Right. So investing is hard.
You want to protect,
right.
Yeah,
right.
You want to protect yourself as much as you can.
Yeah.
But you know, when you see documents that really downplay risk or don't have
yeah.
a large risk section detailing that, you know, it's that's a huge red flag. I mean,
yeah.
I've seen PPMs that had half a page of risk disclosure.
And yeah, so, no, well, I think the thing I think is important to understand there is it's interesting because people look at PPMs in my experience and sometimes it scares them away from an investment, but in reality, you know, as a former surgeon myself, I always liken it to a surgical consent form, right? Like you tell everybody what could happen. And in a lot of times in surgical things, you could have you could die. Right. And if you're willing to put that in there, it doesn't mean it's going to happen, but you're disclosing it and it at least shows you're being honest. And I think that's kind of what you're getting at is if people sort of, are trying to make people feel like there really is, you know, not a lot of risk to it, then that's a red flag.
You know, I don't really consult with operators because
right.
I think I'd be playing both sides of the fence if I was working with them and
right.
working with investors. But I have spoken to quite a few of them. And really, it's more of a sales tool. Like I'm being as transparent as I can.
Right.
You know, here's everything I'm going to follow. Here's everything that could go wrong. Right. And, you know, this document is holding me accountable in terms of what I'm going to do. Right. And as long as I follow this document, you know, not that we'll make, there's no guarantee that we'll make money, but, and I think a lot of operators are a little bit, you know,
yeah,
maybe afraid
yeah.
that it'll scare people away. And especially now too, and I'm sure that you've seen this, you know, I don't want to sound condescending, but you know, you've got, you know, Joe and Mary Smith in Kansas City who own 50 doors and, you know, now they want to, you know, they're experts in the multifamily space,
yeah.
hypothetically. Right.
Yeah.
And they want to start raising money and, you know, yada, yada, yada.
Yeah.
So they don't, you know, upset their potential investors. They don't put a lot of this stuff in there.
Yeah.
So it's really difficult.
Yeah.
Something that I really want to, you know, spend a little time on, and I think people get really, really caught up with it, is the whole profiling of fraudsters.
Yeah. Right?
Profiling
okay.
of bad actors.
Yeah, yeah.
And I really think, you know, get your opinion on this too, but you know, it's so much, you know, the whole profile of a fraudster is that they're the used cars salesman type, you know, very pushy. You got to get this done today. When can you send the money? That type of thing. And yes, there are those types that are out there, but there are just as many, if not more, that would be like myself or the Madoff that are quiet, reserved. Here's what it is. If you want to invest, great. If you don't, great. There's plenty of other people who want to invest, right?
Right.
That don't call you every other day and push for money.
Sure.
And even though there's both out there, you really can't pigeonhole what a bad actor is going to look like.
Right.
You just can't do it because the gamut is from young to old, from experienced in the business, in their career path to somebody just starting out. It just doesn't really matter. And just because someone is not car salesman-y, is not pushing things, doesn't mean there's nothing to worry about.
Right.
And the whole point is you have to check everybody out. It doesn't matter who they are. I mean, when I get something and, when I get a phone call and I'm investigating somebody, it doesn't matter who they are, how old they are, what their career path is, none of that takes into consideration.
Sure.
Because, we just have to go back, go right down the list and start checking everything out, you know? And I think a lot of people, he went to the University of Chicago, went to Northwestern, he's got an MBA from Stanford and, et cetera, et cetera. And he's got all this experience. Yeah. Okay, great. It doesn't mean that he is not committing fraud or will commit fraud in the future.
Yeah.
Right. Cause nobody knows how they will act at that point in time. If they've been, for example, I was in my early 30s and I had, other than having a parking ticket, never had any issues with the law.
Sure.
And never, ever did I think that I would react the way I did, that I was so afraid to sit down with my clients and say, hey, look, we're down 3%. If you want to stay in, great. You want to pull out, great. What do you want to do versus,
right.
Trying to hide it.
Yeah.
And I guess people just never know how you're going to react.
Yeah.
And with that said, you'll never know how somebody else is going to react at that level too.
If you think about Bernie Madoff, it was basically like this little family business, very secretive kind of thing, and yours, what you're talking about, it was pretty much just you. Is it generally harder to get away with a Ponzi scheme if there is a whole team involved, a whole C-suite and accountants and everything like that are not related?
No doubt.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's much more difficult if you're ahead of a legitimate firm and you decide that you want to skew the numbers for whatever reason. It's very hard to recruit those people because of trust, because they're the low hanging fruit. And if something, is amiss, they're the ones that are going to be approached by the SEC or the FBI or whoever it may be. And they're the ones who are probably going to roll.
Yeah.
So, the less people that, in the cases that I've investigated and there's been a few bigger ones where, it was a relatively, a 300 person firm, which is a financial firm that's relatively large. I mean, one other person knew, the VP knew, and of course the president knew, and that was it. But more so than not, when you have smaller firms, and you've got less people that are breaking up all of the activities in the back office. And that's really a big thing. And this is hard for individual investors to do, but really kind of go through that back office and seeing how that architecture is set up and, what the activities that are being done by certain people.
Yeah.
And especially on the trading side, not so much on the real estate side, but you've got, now third party administrators that are there for private equity and for hedge funds that make things a little bit easier. So the hedge fund itself does not take in money. It does not disperse money, that they're not doing their own statements. There's been a little bit of sometimes fraud involved there, but much, much less than if there's a third party administrator involved.
Got it. So tell us, what are you up to now? It sounds like you are the investment fraud guy. That's the, that's your title. You do consulting. Tell us a little bit about your business.
Sure. So I've been working on a book for the past couple of years that I wish was done by now, but which I think is going to be the do-it-yourself guide to looking at investment fraud differently, basically going from, step one to, from A to Z on how somebody can go in and really even the top 10 red flags that somebody could do, they'll probably give them a pretty good idea that there's fraud or that the scenario is ripe for fraud potentially in the future, and you should really be careful. But besides that, you know, I work with high net worth individuals, with sports athletes, to help them, you know, oversee, you know, their investments, making sure that they're not being taken advantage of by, you know, by their managers, by their investment advisors. Spend a lot of time on financial advisor fraud, financial advisor misconduct. We're seeing a lot more of that, and not so much traditionally, which would technically be considered securities fraud, where a broker would be like churning an account or switching mutual funds and annuities to generate commission, but a process by what's called selling away, which means that the broker is actually selling a product that is not on his or her firm's approval list. And it could be a fund. Usually it's a fund, right? A PPM, a private investment that they've set up, or one of their friends have set up, that they can use to funnel money to a third party.
Right.
And it's, they can go to their client and say, hey, I got this great investment, blah, blah, blah. Take a little piece of your portfolio and put it here, and it'll do really well. And of course, you know, the investors don't double check it, but we're seeing a lot more typical investment fraud from registered financial advisors.
Sure. Makes sense. How do people get a hold of you?
They can email me anytime at james@theinvestmentfraudguide.com. I'd be happy to answer any questions for them.
Fantastic. Well, really interesting stuff. I appreciate your time, and love to potentially have you on again sometime after your book gets published.
Absolutely.
We'll be right back. Self-storage is a necessary evil. It's where you keep your stuff and forget about it. No wonder this stuff is so profitable and recession-resistant. The Wealth Formula community, well, we've benefited from that. We've made lots of money in this space with Reliant Real Estate, one of the largest self-storage companies in the country. With an average investor internal rate of return of almost 34%, with hold times just over 3.5 years, these guys know what the meaning of velocity of money is. If you're an accredited investor, make sure to check out what they're up to right now at ReliantFund4.com. Again, that's ReliantFund4.com. Welcome back to the show, everyone. Hope you enjoyed it. And again, I think very incredibly fascinating story and scary stuff. But all I can say is, you know, the thing that you got to do in this space is you've just got to understand, right, that you know, before you can even get into whether something looks like a good investment or a bad investment and all that, some of the basic things that you have to do are, you know, simply to do background checks and to do, you know, or make sure that background checks are done, or, you know, Google somebody, you know what I mean? See if they actually pop up and exist in the ether. Because if they don't exist on Google, they probably, you know, they probably don't exist, because there's plenty of people who exist on Google who don't exist. It doesn't usually work the other way, though. Anyway, that's it for me this week on Wealth Formula Podcast. Hope you enjoyed the show. This is Buck Jaffrey signing off.
Thank you for listening to the Wealth Formula Podcast. Visit us on the web at wealthformula.com. The information contained in this podcast are opinions, not fact. As always, consult your own financial team before making any investment. See you next time.
Buck Jaffrey here from Sapio with Buck Jaffrey. Aging might become reversible over the next 10 to 20 years. It's already being done in lab animals, so it's just a matter of time. Our challenge? To be healthy enough for when that time comes. As a former scientist and surgeon myself, my goal is to figure out how to do that and to share it with you. I wrote a book called Living Longer for Busy People that you can download for free at sapiopodcast.com. You'll be amazed at just how a few daily adjustments can add years of a healthy life for you. Again, download it for free, sapiopodcast.com.